Welcome into the Titan-Sized Podcast. I'm Luke Worsham, joined by the other two hosts of the Titan-Sized Podcast, Matthias Wadner and Will Lomas. And today we are going to be joined by a really great NFL analyst. His name is Johnny Kinsley. I'm sure a lot of you know him on Twitter as @BrickWallBlitz. He makes GIF threads. He charts quarterbacks' deep throws. He just does a lot of really awesome stuff on Twitter. And we're really glad to have him on the show today. But before we get him on, we're going to talk a little bit about the Combine, which is coming up soon. It starts on Friday and goes Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And so let's just chat a little bit about some prospects we like. And we'll start with the inside linebacker position, because I think this is, at least top-heavy anyway, a pretty solid draft at that position. Obviously, Roquan Smith is going to be long gone by the time the Titans are on the clock. But two names that one will certainly be there, I feel like, but one has a chance to be. Those guys are Malik Jefferson from Texas and Rashawn Evans from Alabama. Two very athletic inside linebackers that from early looks seem to fit the mold of what that position is becoming in the NFL today. So I'll ask you guys to sort of chat about your thoughts on those two players as prospects and sort of your thoughts on the philosophy of taking an inside linebacker in the first round, because it's obviously a position the Titans are going to need a new player at, with Avery Williamson likely departing.
Yeah, honestly, personally, I'm not totally sold on taking an inside linebacker in the first round. It is a position that is still important, but it has been devalued over the years. And I just feel like you can get a decent inside linebacker in the middle or later rounds that could give you essentially the same production that maybe a guy in the first round would. I mean, I've seen a little bit of Malik Jefferson, and I've seen him in games just not make it much of an impact at all, especially in the run game. He seems like, I'm not going to say he's, I remember Mike Mayock once saying this about Zach Brown, that he was allergic to contact. And at times it kind of feels like Malik Jefferson is that. He's not really attacking a lot of the time. And this isn't in every game, of course, but I have seen that in a couple games, in a couple big ones too. The good thing about Malik Jefferson is he's incredibly fast, incredibly athletic, and he's a fantastic blitzer when the defensive coordinator uses him on blitzes, which they did a lot of throughout his career. And Rashawn Evans, I would take over him at this point. Rashawn Evans is just a little bit more more proven. I wouldn't say he's more athletic, but he's a more sound tackler, definitely better in the run game, and seems to be able to diagnose plays a lot better than Malik Jefferson can. But I just don't know if I would commit to one of those players in the first round, especially in a draft that has some edge talent at that spot and even running back talent at that spot. And I think you can get someone like T. Gray Scales from Indiana, who was a fantastic college player, and for some reason isn't getting talked about along with some of these linebackers, and he honestly might be just as good as them, and he may go a couple rounds later.
Yeah, Scales is good. A guy named Sidgey from Wisconsin, who didn't play, Jack Sidgey, I think, from Wisconsin, who didn't play this year, is outstanding when he's healthy. He probably would have been a first-round guy if he'd have been healthy. Josie Jewell from Iowa is really solid. The thing is the Titans already found the hard linebacker to get, the coverage linebacker. It's easier to find.
You're talking about Avery Williamson, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, the great cover linebacker. When you've already got that, it really de-emphasizes that position, because you can start taking away tight ends when you use them correctly, and you can be more sideline to sideline. I mean, Malik's good. He's good. He'll be a good second round guy, I think. I don't think he'll be a first round guy. Evans is different. Evans is violent. I mean, when he hits people, sometimes it looks like a car crash. I mean, he is aggressive, which I love. Alabama defenders are known for that in college, and it's different when, you know, you're allowed to shoot a gap and stuff because you've got, you know, 5-4 stars sitting right behind you who will make the play if you miss it. There's a difference confidence level there. But, I mean, he's not Reuben Foster because he's not sideline to sideline. He's not that sort of freak athlete, cover every blade of grass. But, I mean, you don't want to see him inside the box. I mean, and he can cover some, and he's not, I mean, he's not stiff, but I mean, he's the perfect guy to pair with Jayon Brown. So if the Titans did take a linebacker in the first round, I'd want it to be Evans. Having said that, I don't think there's any need to take that over, you know, pass rusher.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of pass rusher, let's hit that position. When we did a little mock draft where we went through and sort of alternated teams, and when we got to the Titans pick it at 25, that ended up being my selection. And obviously the Titans have a big need at pass rusher, but at that point, and the thing we did, there wasn't anything there. You had already taken Hercules Mata'afa, Will, and Harold Landry was off the board, and I don't think Arden Key is a very good fit in what the Titans do. I think he would be another Kevin Dodd, to be completely honest, just a bad fit. But at that position in a whole, it seems like a pretty strong draft up front. You know, I mentioned Arden Key. Obviously, the Boston College kid, what's his name again? Bradley Landry. Chubb.
Landry.
NC State. My bad. NC State.
Yes, yeah.
He's going top five.
Well, he's
going
to be long gone.
Yeah. But aside from him, you have Okoronkwo from Oklahoma. You have, as I mentioned, Hercules Mata'afa, Harold Landry. So of those three guys, I know your answer, Will, and yours will probably be similar, Matias, but which do you think is the best option for the Titans, and why? And do you think that is the position they need to go after?
Yeah, I don't want to steal Will's spotlight, because I mean, he knows more about Mata'afa than I do. But from what I've seen from Mata'afa, there's no doubt that he is the perfect fit for Mike Vrabel in terms of what Vrabel wants, which he's already said it's front multiplicity. And Mata'afa is literally the definition of front multiplicity, right? Because he played defensive tackle in college at 250 pounds, and he was mauling everyone. No one could block him. And at the next level, I see him as an edge pass rusher. But even on passing downs, he can absolutely kick in and just play inside and wreak havoc. So, I mean, I'll let Will talk more about him. But, I mean, I still love Harold Landry as a prospect. I'm not sure he's going to make it all the way to 25. I know people want to say that his 2016 season was a fluke, but I don't think it was at all. He was struggling with an injury this past season and was still making plays. He's really good at bending around tackles, around blocks. And he's a fantastic pass rusher, and I'd be totally fine with either of those guys.
Yeah. Harold Landry's good. I like him. He's kind of one note, but it's a really good note. I mean, he can get around and replace the shoulder or the offensive tackle and get behind him. I mean, he's really good. And if you watched him last year, you would have, I mean, and you knew the Titans were going to pick at 25, you'd be, you know, ecstatic to have him. My thing is, yeah, it's got to be Mata'afa. So in case y'all don't follow me on Twitter, Mata'afa is Washington State's defensive tackle. He plays the exact same position that Solomon Thomas played.
Stop. Who is crunching potato
doing that?
Chips in front of their microphone?
Not me. I don't have any. It
can't
be me. I'm
talking. I can't do it anymore. I had to take my headphones off.
What was that?
Is it me?
Yes.
Yeah, it is.
I'm not doing anything.
You're crunching potato chips in front of the microphone. That's what it sounds like.
I don't have potato chips. I was talking.
Okay, well, talk.
Is it still
good? I just saw a play where Landry got injured. Go ahead, sorry.
Jarvis Landry?
No, Harold Landry.
Okay, what do you mean?
Oh my gosh, what is it doing now?
I'm sitting here.
I think you're fine now.
No, I heard more noises. Like, worse.
Hello?
What?
All right, keep
I think we're good.
Yeah, just go. Oh,
okay.
Goodness.
What was that?
Did y'all still hear it?
No.
We will in a minute, but...
Okay, so is it just going to sound like I'm crunching potato chips while I'm trying to give my explanation on the podcast?
It sounds fine right now.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to talk about Mata'afa.
Okay.
So the answer is Mata'afa. You know, he's the guy that Titans fans should want. He's a defensive tackle for Washington State. If you don't know, he plays the exact same position that Solomon Thomas played in the exact same conference, except he's better at pretty much everything. He's clearly built for defensive end, so you don't have to worry about where you're going to play him. I mean, he is as explosive and flexible and, you know, effort-driven. He's everything you want in a player. And because people didn't stay up late at night and watch the Pac-12, they don't know a lot about him, and they're, you know, they're easy to rush to other bigger names. But this combine's a great time to watch him and see how he does in his three cone and all that. If he does well here, people will start saying, oh, well, I always thought he was a top 40 guy, even though everybody has said that he's a day three guy or, a late day two guy. But everybody will say, well, I've always thought his film was top 40, but I was hearing that, you know, he was going to go later. But now I'm hearing after that he's going to – if you watch the film and honestly watch the film, you know he's a first-round guy. So, you know, I'm really excited to see him, but he would – you know, I would be head over heels with him at 25.
Well, what's the most important drill for a pass rusher, not outside pass rusher?
Three cone. It, being able to bend, like, it, I mean, it's good to be fast. It's good to be quick off the ball. But if you can bend, it's really hard to block you. That and reactionary speed. So if I'm a pass rusher, first off, if I'm fast, I'm going to win enough to stay in the NFL for 10 years. So if I can get off the ball quickly, that's great. If I can bend and stay low, and you can stay lower than the offensive tackle's hands, they can't touch you, and that's why Von Miller is so good.
Hmm.
If I have a counter move, then I can stay in the NFL for 10 years like DeMarcus Ware did, where I can set you up outside, and all of that comes from three cone and understanding of football. So if you can bend and stay low around those cones, which is why, you know, how people get faster times, it will lead to more success in the NFL. I don't believe there's anything that's more of a one-to-one correlation to success is three cone. And then you have to judge it by body size. I mean, if Ndamukong Suh, who I think had a really good, you know, just draft and or draft process in general, if he has a 6.9 second three cone, which I can't imagine he did. That'd be crazy. It's not the same as if Leonard Floyd had a 6.9 three cone.
Yeah.
Because you factor in all those different things. But if there's one drill to watch, it's the three cone.
Matias, before we move on from edge rushers, talk a little bit about Okoronkwo, because I know you like him a lot.
Oh, baby. What a player this guy is. I sound like John Gruden. No, but I really do like him. The hype has kind of died down on him. I'm not sure why. I mean, he had a really good final season at Oklahoma, and I think he's a perfect edge rusher. I'm not sure how big he is. He does seem a little. Is he like 6'1" or something like that? I don't know. No. I don't really think it matters. The way he plays is. He's pretty violent. He has a lot of good pass rush moves. He can beat you in a variety of ways. He's a good run defender. He has a great motor, which is important. And he did it for a big-time school, and he was very productive. And I don't know what else you would want from a pass rusher.
He was listed at 6'1", 240.
Yeah, so he was kind of – it's a weird dimensions
wow.
for
– NFL.com has him pegged as a 4-5 round pick.
Yeah.
That is absurd. Absurd if you've ever seen him play.
Yeah, it's a lot of this like speculation and one guy kind of watching 1.5 games of him and saying that, you know, it, not that he's necessarily a 1-to-1 because I think he's better, but Elvis Dumervil is somebody who was like sub 6 foot and was really good and had really high peaks in the NFL. Elvis Dumervil, if he retires, which I think he is, or is about to. He ended his career with over 100 sacks. I mean, you don't have to be 6'4", and he was 5'11", his Wikipedia page says 5'11", 250 pounds. So you want to talk about some weird dimensions.
If someone is 5'11", and 250 pounds, that's unique.
Don't. Yeah. He was unique.
One last topic before we hop into our talk with Jonathan, the running back position. Who was it? Was it Mel Kiper that pegged the Titans taking Ronald Jones in the first round?
Rojo.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Kiper.
Look, you know, I'm very critical of Derrick Henry, but look, he's a starter. And the Titans, I think, would be smarter to just draft or sign a Charles Sims or a Jerick McKinnon to back him up in free agency, because I don't think either of those guys is going to cost all that much money, like maybe $3-5 million a year tops. And so I think that would be a better option than spending a draft pick, especially a day one draft pick on a player like that. But this is a pretty good running back class. Obviously Saquon Barkley, but behind him you have Ronald Jones, you have Sony Michel. We thought we were going to have Bryce Love. We ended up not getting him. You have the other Georgia running back, Nick Chubb. A lot of people, Tennessee fans anyway, seem to think John Kelly is going to be the next big thing. But this is a good – I'm not going to say it's a great class, especially after Bryce Love said he was going to stay at school. But it's a quality class for sure.
Yeah, so first let me defend Ronald Jones because I love him as a prospect. He's a really good running back. He reminds me a lot of Jamal Charles, and it's not just the dreads and his number. He really does. He has a similar build to him, and he's also has a lot of underrated power in that slight frame. Really smooth pass catcher, and he can hit a home run from anywhere. He's electric, and he's really fast, and he's got pretty good vision. So I like him. The problem is I wouldn't spend a first round pick on him. Just because this is a pretty deep running back class, and it's specifically deep in the type of running back that the Titans should be looking for, which is a pass-catching running back. So there's players like Sony Michel. I don't think he's going to make it to the second-round pick for the Titans, but regardless, there's Sony Michel. John Kelly's a really good smooth pass catcher out of the backfield as well. Kalen Ballage from where's he from? Arizona State, I think. Mark Walton from Miami. Akram Wadley from Iowa. There are so many pass-catching running backs in this draft that you could pair perfectly with Derrick Henry if you're totally sold on Derrick Henry. So I don't see the need for the Titans to use a first-round pick on one when you can get one several rounds later.
Yeah, so just kind of to point out running back history – last year, you could get the fifth best running back in the second round where the Titans pick. So let's say you love Barkley, which, okay. Then let's say your next guys are in some order Ronald Jones, Sony Michel, and Geis. So now you're at four. Then you kind of have to say, okay, do I like Nick Chubb enough to take him there? It gets kind of hazy. So historically, you're going to have to trade up if you want one of those four guys. So that it's a concern. I say all this because in my head, I know that it makes no sense to draft a running back in the first round, period. Historically, you get more value. There's no way if you ask them and they're, you know, if they drink truth serum or whatever, that the Jaguars would tell you that they're happy with Leonard Fournette, that they would have much rather had Kareem Hunt or Kamara in that draft if they knew everything they know now. So, and both of those guys were third-round picks. So there's just not a ton of value there. But then, like I said, you're going to have to find somebody who fits your offense well, which I think works with LaFleur because I think he'll kind of help massage that and make it easier. That's all to say, you know, I wouldn't mind taking Ronald Jones if the rest of the draft was really solid, but it's not a draft I think that would turn the Titans into Super Bowl contenders. It would be something that I think makes them just kind of more sustainable. Matias, you're the big Miami guy. What do you think about, what is it, Walton, their running back?
Mark Walton.
Yeah, what do you think about him? I haven't watched him yet.
So at Miami, he was essentially a workhorse running back until he went down with injury. And then Travis Homer came in for him, and he was really good. But before Walton went down, he was essentially the number one guy. He's kind of small, but he reminds me a lot of Giovanni Bernard. He's a really good pass catcher out of the backfield. But what separates Walton from a lot of other running backs in his draft class is his balance. So whenever he takes contact and it looks like he's about to go down, he just has this uncanny ability to stay on his feet either by using his hands or just his ridiculous legs to stay on his feet and work through contact and keep gaining yards. So even though he looks small and he's probably going to be typecast as a pass catching running back, I do think he could be a lot more than that. And I think he could be a 15 to 20 carry a game running back at the next level, in addition to being a really solid receiving back.
Okay, so with that in mind, that's kind of what I've heard about him, but I don't trust anybody unless they've seen him, and I know you've watched him for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Would you take him in the fourth round instead of taking a running back in the first round?
No doubt. Yeah. I don't think he's going to last that long, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the kind of thing is, like, all these guys, Kamara shouldn't have lasted. We heard talks that Kamara was going to be a first-round running back.
Yeah,
you know, right before the draft, and he should have been. I mean,
I have receipts on Alvin Kamara. Look at my Twitter.
Yeah,
like a year and a half ago, I said Alvin Kamara is going to be really good in the NFL. Trust me on this.
Mainly, it was just Luke yelling it at us while we were like, "I don't know if Kamara is going to go high," and he just kept screaming round one at us. So maybe that's all the buzz. But I mean, like guys like that fall through the cracks all the time. David Johnson was like, you know, guys just, you know. It's year after year we've learned don't spend a first-round pick on a running back. In fact, Mel Kiper is Mr. Don't spend a first-round pick on a running back, if memory serves, and yet, you know, his auto-draft formula or whatever he had ended up with the top draft Ronald Jones. Just like we were drafting Goddard, the South Dakota – or is that what it is, South Dakota State tight end?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what we had the week before. So let's not put too much credit in Mel Kiper. And y'all should read the book Illegal Procedure. It's got some interesting Mel Kiper stuff in there about kind of why maybe don't listen to him as much as you think you should. But I don't know how far I'm allowed to say without actually slandering somebody. So I'll just also say it's all legend.
My first thought upon the selection of Alvin Kamara in the third round. Well, actually, I had two. Number one, why did he last this long? And number two, why did the Saints take him? Because that was when they had Mark Ingram and Adrian Peterson.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was talk of Kamara being considered like a slot receiver by a lot of teams, and that's why a lot of teams were interested in him. I think even the Titans were mentioned as a possible interested team, but that
gosh,
didn't come to fruition.
Oh, gosh, if only that had happened.
Yeah, we were also linked to McCaffrey. That we wanted him as a slot receiver type, so I don't know.
I'm going to order maybe this book, Will. It looks interesting.
It's great. It's a really good book. It'll make you kind of respect the draft process in a whole different way.
We've got a special guest with us today, and that is Jonathan Kinsley. I know a lot of you guys know him from the Marcus Mariota Twitter thread he did a couple weeks ago. His Twitter handle is Brickwall Blitz. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for taking time.
Thanks a lot for having me. How are you guys doing?
Doing pretty well. You ready to talk some football? Because I'm excited to pick your brain on some things that I think a lot of, not just local, but national media people ignore. So let's hop on into it.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So I did a radio interview last week, and they asked me a question that I was like, had no answer to. And the question was, how would you evaluate Marcus Mariota as to where he is in his career right now? And that's a question that I've really struggled with because we've seen, like in his sophomore season, just how accurate he could be. And, you know, he won AFC Offensive Player of the Month in November. But then this year, you know, people want to blame it on the offense, but there were plenty of times when he would throw the ball right to a safety. And some of that may be scheme-based, whatever. But so start out by answering that question for us. How much of Mariota's poor play last season goes to Robiski, goes to the lack of a running game, a crowded, cluttered offense, and how much of it is a Marcus Mariota problem?
Well, to start, I personally think that Mariota was set up to fail from the beginning by the coaching because Mariota was put in an offense where he wasn't set up to be this, be a pocket passer, which to me is where he's at his personal best. He was often throwing the ball vertically with unproven vertical receivers. Corey Davis was injured. Tiamon Taylor was dropping passes. Delaney Walker was dropping passes. Eric Decker was dropping passes. Everybody was dropping passes. Nobody was creating separation. And in addition, the offense was also asking him to be flawless, throw inside impossible windows with generally seven guys blocking and two receivers downfield. So this made it impossible for him to thrive in. Now, a lot of people are wondering, was Terry Robiskie actually as bad as people seem to think? The correct answer is yes. Yes. Maybe even more. I mean, this was probably the worst game I've ever seen.
How long have you been watching film like you do now?
I would say 4 years. 4.5 years.
Okay.
4.5 years. That's still a lot.
Which means you saw the Ken Wisenhunt Titans offense, which wasn't much better.
Oh God, that one looks like Sean McVay's scheme. This, like this. Hugh Jackson's looks like Bill Belichick's comparison. And yeah, I'm very well aware 9-7 is a lot better than 0-16, but work with me here, guys. Work with me. Robiskie was terrible, but the bigger problem to me was that Mike Mularkey did absolutely nothing to convince him to adjust the play call. Absolutely nothing. Throughout the entire season, just said, oh, well, we will stick with Terry Robiskie. We will stick with the plan we have. And, yeah, they barely made the playoffs because of that. That, in turn, ultimately sealed Mike Mularkey's fate in Tennessee because of his loyalty to Robiskie, and then the ownership eventually fired them both. So Mariota had a lot of bad stuff in that offense. He had a lot of turnovers. He had a lot of inaccurate throws. But given the circumstances he had to face, I think that every competent passer, even guys like Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, Russell Wilson, Drew Brees, every one of those guys would suffer under that offense if they had to fit the ball into the windows Mariota had to.
Real quick, when you say that Robiskie's offense was bad, what exactly do you mean by that? Because we hear fans complaining that, oh, it's run, pass, and it's predictable. What do you think is so bad about the system that was run last season?
Well, the problem with that is it's basically the exact same system as it was in 2016. It really wasn't that predictable, but because no one saw it coming, which means it wasn't predictable, but nevertheless, the Titans were able to have a lot more success than that, and Mario's stats were able to go up. The problem is, here's what typically happens in the Titans offense. You got seven guys dropping back, protecting Mariota. This makes the pass protection all that much better at the cost of the amount of receivers going downfield. Because the Titans usually had two vertical guys going downfield, very isolated routes, very cluttered. No one could create any separation. And it suffocated the entire offense. And I don't even need to get started about the trick plays. Those were probably the absolute worst I've ever seen. You think Chuck Pagano's fourth down punt play call was awful? Yeah, just imagine that, except multiplied by a billion, and you get Robiskie's off.
So you mean to tell me you're not a fan of a red zone reverse to Eric Decker that ends up being a double pass?
Yes, amazing.
Fun fact about that: I believe they did two rollouts in two different games against the Chiefs, both on 2-point conversions. And guess what? Both completely failed. Because
hate rollout plays. Hate them. Especially when the Titans have them.
Yeah.
I mean, it just depends. It just depends. If you have misdirection, you're able to do it. The problem was the Titans didn't have any misdirection. Everyone was going in the exact same direction, so the defense solid. It was an easy read. No one was going out to the opposite direction.
And it was Harry Douglas most of the time. So.
Yeah, man. Don't disrespect Harry Douglas, the best fifth receiver. I don't know. he's a water boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a coach. So sticking to Marcus Mariota and going outside of the scheme, essentially, in terms of him as a quarterback, when everything is perfect, he has a clean pocket, his receivers are running good routes, what is his biggest strength and what do you think is his biggest weakness as well?
Well, in previous seasons, Titans fans often said that Marcus Mariota was this very efficient, very accurate downfield passing guy. when, to me, this is more of a case of the Titans giving him a bunch of passes to throw the ball deep to. So it was a case of volume over efficiency. However, when I charted him for my deep ball project after 2016, his accuracy on all throws of 16-plus air yards was 43.6%, which ranked 26 out of 31 quarterbacks in the 2016-2017 edition of the deep ball project. However, in 2017, his accuracy in that area was 62.4%, which would have ranked fifth if it were charted that year. Not sure what changed, but I just assume he took a great step up in accuracy on vertical throws. And the irony is, I think this in a year where everyone thought he took a massive step down. So, I guess his weakness is he's not really the most mobile quarterback, although that's kind of a nitpick. He's not a guy like Tony Romo or Aaron Rodgers. He has good mobility, but not that mobility. Again, that's nitpicking. His arm strength isn't really to the level of Matthew Stafford or Aaron Rodgers. Again, nitpicking. So those are basically the flaws I have with him. Like those are very, very tiny, quote-unquote, flaws that don't really matter. What do matter are his strengths. So his pocket movement is incredibly underrated. Vision is underrated. Progressions are underrated. He's at his absolute best as a pocket passer. I'm pretty sure you guys know this as well as anyone. He can diagnose coverages by moving defenders with his eyes as he's throwing the ball, creating open receivers with these, quote-unquote, no-look passes. It's honestly one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen as a quarterback analyst. And he's been doing it since, I think, his sophomore season. So that's something that's developed along his career.
And let's get this straight real quick. You're not a Titans fan saying this, right? You're not going to games wearing a Mariota jersey.
I could be if the Browns continue to suck. I need a team to root for. I rooted for the Vikings last year. I need to root for the underdog. The underdog good team. Mm-hmm. The good underdog team.
That's us.
Yeah. He also has excellent footwork, and despite what John Gruden may say, he has great ability against pressure, isn't really fazed by it.
Gruden had no idea what he was talking about whenever we were on Monday Night Football.
He thought he was a running quarterback. It was like it didn't make any sense at all. He's just going with the exact same stereotypes that Mario was facing when he was at Oregon.
Did the Titans go to Oakland this year?
They did not. Oakland came to Tennessee.
No. Do they go this coming season? I think they go to Oakland. Because Oakland finished second in that division, I feel like. Or no, the Chargers did. That's right. We go to San Diego.
Yeah, Oakland finished third. That was terrible.
I have a theory that is the first week that Gruden got the offer to be the next Oakland coach is because after that, he had phoned it in every single – I mean – he just kind of fell back in the background and just started repeating the same stuff he'd repeated for years. I mean, that was when he started becoming the worst analyst on TV. It was just hard to listen to.
Yeah, I agree. He was normally like a quality play-by-play guy in previous season. Yeah, like you said, he was just completely phoning it in.
It was like Tony Romo sucked his soul out. Like, I mean,
I hope that never happens to Romo. I hope he continues to do what he's doing.
Yeah.
Lord knows we need it.
So, anyway, is that Mario's accuracy is phenomenal. His downfield accuracy is a lot better this year than it was last year. And I personally think his production should flourish on the floor with the hopefully more versatile style of offense that he should be able to bring.
So, I'm a former offensive lineman. We've kind of talked enough about quarterback for a second. So,
nice.
One of the things that really, really, really makes me mad this offseason is everybody wants to mock a tight end or a center or a guard of the Titans. There's obviously no need for a tight end. They've got every kind of prototype you could want there.
Mm-hmm.
Offensive line, as far as I understand zone blocking schemes, which is what Los Angeles is going to bring, there's not a heavy emphasis on guard and center play. You don't invest heavily in those positions because – there's just not value there. Like, really, if you're the center, all you have to do is reach the next gap over and be able to either move up to linebacker or hook the shoulder if you're running your stretch plays. It's just not a hard position to fill. Chris Myers was, a bottom-of-the-barrel guy who got tons of Pro Bowl nods year after year with the Texans in some similar version of this offense. And every time I see that the Titans need to go out and add another guard or center with their first-round pick, it drives me crazy. You study this stuff a lot more intently than I do. Am I way off base here?
Well, what needs to be realized about the zone blocking scheme, first off, is guards are half of the equation. You need to have good guard play and good tackle play, generally. Sometimes there's a center that assists a guard. So, but mostly, you need a good guard play, good tackle play, for these double blocks to successfully work on the left side and the right side. You have a left tackle and a left guard blocking a guy, and then you have the right guard and right tackle blocking a guy. Simple stuff. It's actually one area to me that I actually really like from Rubitsky, because they regularly ran this style of zone blocking. There's actually a quote from the former Rams offensive coordinator head coach Mike Martz on the zone blocking scheme. He says, if you want to run zone running plays, you have to do it over and over again. You have to have reps. And that's basically what the Titans and Rams both have done after watching both offenses. So investing in the guard is clearly important. There's an example of this. You guys may be familiar with this. Derrick Henry's game-sealing run against the Colts Monday night came on a brilliant, brilliant zone blocking play call on 3rd and 5. Brilliant. Rubitsky and brilliant. Two things I never thought I'd say in the same sentence. But here we go. It happened. So, on this play, it's an outside zone scheme. There are two tight ends on the far left. The center, Ben Jones, assists the zone block on the right, while the right guard, Josh Klein, is running across the line of scrimmage to lead a path for Henry. He's running outside Delaney Walker and Jonnu Smith, which makes it an outside zone scheme because they typically go outside the tight end. The right tackle manages to block the defensive end that is trying to chase down Henry, and he prevents the outside linebacker is the one chasing down Henry. Defensive end is going up. But the outside linebacker is trying to chase Henry. The right tackle chases him down with a block. The Colts have 9 guys near the line of scrimmage on this play, and no one is dropped back outside to help cover and bring Henry down. So there is a complete gap over there that the Titans are ready to exploit. So with the right guard, Klein, providing a block on the left corner, no one is close to bringing Henry down. So it's a brilliant play call, and because of the perfect execution of the double blocks, Henry is able to use his sideline ability to take off, score a touchdown. So guard play is very important in the zone blocking scheme. Definitely one of the key elements, one of the two major key elements. And the Titans can invest in a guard like Andrew Norwell with the Panthers or Justin, who was previously with the Bears. And I think both guys are really talented. But Norwell probably might be the better signing because he's younger, he's healthier than Sidden. Sidden missed a couple of games last year, I believe. And so to conclude, in the Flores offense, guard play is absolutely crucial because guys like Roger Saffold, Jamon Brown were heavily involved in zone blocking last year. Combination was phenomenal. Quinton Spain played with a foot injury, so we don't know what they'll do with him. They might move on from Klein. I'm not sure.
He is a free agent.
That makes sense. So an investment in either Noel or Sidden would do really well for the Titans in the floor long term, and I think they can move that out to either left guard or right guard, depending on what they see fit.
Perhaps more than anyone else, I have been very critical of Derrick Henry, really for the last year and a half. And it's because when he was at Alabama, we saw him. Obviously, he's not going to have the same kind of production, but we saw him hitting the inside, running over linebackers, and getting to the second level and outrunning safeties. And what for the last 2 years I have sat in Nissan Stadium and seen him do is hit the hole and then run backwards and try to get the edge. And he always just gets pushed out of bounds.
Try to get to the sideline.
Yeah, and he made the comments prior to the wild card game against Kansas City. I run soft. I need to run tougher. And he did in that one game. But then against the Patriots, it was right back to the same stuff. In half of the Titans games this season, 9 of the 18, Henry ran for 3.25 yards per carry or less. Am I crazy for thinking that Derrick Henry is someone who has no idea how to use his talent and that the Titans need another running back to help him out this year that's not DeMarco Murray?
I'll tell you what, it's not completely crazy. He definitely needs more carries. He's a guy that for some reason was better than Murray despite the worthy criticisms you presented. And yet they still started Murray despite the fact that he was a lot slower. He lacked the power that he had in like 2014. And he lacked the quickness after getting the ball. So he was constantly easily stopped and typically got, what, like 3 yards a carry? I think the Titans should move on from him, and they definitely do need a back to compliment Henry. I haven't actually watched any of the running back prospects yet. I've been too busy with the threads, and I've been too busy watching the quarterback prospects. But I think they could use a couple of free agents. I think C.J. Anderson is available. I think he would be a good option. I'm not a big Amir Abdullah guy, but they could consider him if
trade. Some of the guys that Titans fans mention a lot? I know a lot of fans say Jerick McKinnon. You did. I saw Jim Coburn do something on him today. I'm not a huge McKinnon fan. I really like Charles Sims from Tampa Bay. What about those guys?
Well, I think McKinnon's a very good receiving back. He's always been in a situation where he's been running behind a bad offensive line, and then last year he gets a good offensive line for a change, and as you saw, like his stats were a lot better because he was in a better scheme. He was constantly getting more space, and he was able to get more yards as a result. Charles Sims is a guy that is crazy fast. In his defense, the reason he's not really so sought after is because he's a receiving back in an offense that has Mike Evans, DeSean Jackson,
yeah,
Cameron Brait, OJ Howard, Adam Humphries, and Chris Godwin. So there's all these receivers that they're trying to develop and they're trying to distribute the ball to. And then there's this receiving back. Buccaneers aren't known for the running game at all. Doug Martin fell off completely. That's why they released him. Charles Sims would definitely be a good option to complement Henry. So with Henry, he definitely needs more carries. Like you said, he's a guy that constantly goes to the sideline, which is completely aggravating. Part of it might be on the coaching, but it's the other parts definitely his instincts. One thing that needs to be certain is he needs to be involved a lot more in the passing game. Let me pull up the stats up here. Let's see. He had 11 receptions for 136 yards all season in a passing game. And 66 of those yards came on a screen in week 17, a 66-yard touchdown against the Jaguars. That's 66 of his 136 yards of receiving all season. That is atrocious, and Matt LaFleur is definitely going to need to get him a lot more reps in the passing game as a result.
The problem is he looks really awkward sometimes when he's going on those routes and trying to catch passes. But
he does.
I mean, it needs to be like a completely clean catch for him to actually do something after the catch. But going back to the quarterback position, because it is the most important position on the field. And going into the 2017 season, I think Titans fans were very optimistic about where they were as a team, and especially at the quarterback position. And especially with Andrew Luck not practicing and going through that shoulder injury. But things changed in the 2017 season. Mariota, as many Titans fans would have you believe, was terrible and regressed, even though that's not true, but it doesn't matter. That's what a lot of people think. Deshaun Watson was lighting it up when he was in there. Blake Bortles even was making plays late in the season because his offensive coordinator was fantastic. Yeah. And he had a good wide receiver corps. But regardless, right now, if you were to rank the AFC South quarterbacks, how would you rank them? And let's assume that Andrew Luck right now is the previous version that we saw of him.
Well, if he's the previous version, I'm definitely going with him at number one. Mariota's a close number two. I probably have Watson at number three, and then I have Bortles at like five. I take one of the backup quarterbacks from either team. Maybe like who? Oh yeah, Jacoby Brissett. Jacoby Brissett at number four.
Yeah.
And then Bortles at number five. He's that big.
I know that Will really doesn't like Deshaun Watson very much. You want to talk about that, Will?
Here's my thing with Deshaun Watson, and it may just be my bias speaking up, and it may not be. When I watch him, it looks like he doesn't play just super in the framework of the system. It seems like he's kind of a scramble around guy who just throws a lot of deep balls, who he happens to have the fastest receiver in the NFL that's actually playing instead of John Ross. And like one of the, you know, the guy who should lead the NFL in offensive pass interference in DeAndre Hopkins.
Yeah.
You have those guys, and nobody's calling any flags. It seems to be real easy to just run around until they run open and chunk the ball deep. Now, I know that that's not – I don't know exactly what you've seen, but I know you've done a lot of work on the difference between Watson and Savage in terms of, you know, what went wrong and why. Because I'm going to be honest, I wasn't a believer in Watson, and then slowly as the year went on, it seemed like teams had no idea how to defend him, and they were going to let him scramble around. And I was much more worried down the stretch about the Texans than I was the Jaguars, because I knew at the end of the year, whatever the Jaguars were doing right would end up fading away because they were putting their faith in Blake Bortles. And that didn't happen the way I thought it would, but eventually it did, you know, a little mistake against the Patriots not going for it. Anyway, the big question is what happened to the Texans, and am I right about Deshaun Watson?
First off, I feel like you have more of a problem with DeAndre Hopkins than you do Watson.
Well, like, that's just common sense. Cheats every play. But that's,
I mean, in your defense, like, yeah, he's probably the king of offensive pass interference.
Yeah.
I'd say that he is a fan of his. But anyway, I actually do agree to extend. Like, I actually don't think Watson is that good, to be honest. And it's a good thing I'm on a Titans podcast and not a Texans podcast, because I'd get cut off right now. Well, I would get murdered. But here, let's see what you have to say about this. You said he's not good. Let's dive in. I want more. Anyway, I didn't think he was that good. He did some positive things in his rookie season, some, but he was in a great system. He was constantly throwing off balance under pressure, was generally inaccurate, wasted clean pockets by dropping his eyes and taking unnecessary sacks. And, of course, the play of DeAndre Hopkins, Will Fuller, Bruce Ellington greatly helped as well, because those three receivers are very good at catching the ball and creating separation. The bigger issue to me for the Texans offense regressing completely is Bill O'Brien completely changing the offense in the absence of Watson. With Deshaun Watson, Bill O'Brien gave his rookie quarterback tons of play action, tons of option plays. So this was making the offensive line so much better. The receivers were easily open, and Watson's job was a lot easier. When Tom Savage came in, Bill O'Brien took away the play action read option. And considering what Nick Foles just did in Carson Wentz's absence, leading him to the Super Bowl, winning Super Bowl MVP with the exact same core offense as with Carson Wentz, there's no excuse for Bill O'Brien to change the offense. Look, Foles is a complete statue in the pocket, but you do not need to be mobile to run RPOs or play action. It certainly helps, but it's not a deal breaker if you're not mobile. O'Brien didn't understand that, and as a result, Savage got more pressure, had to throw with more precision to Watson. I actually have a few stats that I like to bring up from the Deep Ball Project, surveying these guys throwing downfield. Deshaun Watson versus Tom Savage, 2017. Their total accuracy on all throws of 16-plus yards, Watson, 39.2%, which is extremely low. Savage, ready? 50%. 50%.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm as mind-blown as you guys are. I'm just like, what? How is Tom Savage not atrocious in accuracy? He's horrible. How is this happening? I don't understand that. I still don't understand that, but it happened. Anyway.
Crazy.
But there's more to this. Watson received play action on 16 of his 51 downfield passes. That's 31.4%. He was accurate on 5 of those 16 passes, which is 31.3%. Savage, on the other hand, received 7 play action passes he received 7 of his total 44. 7 of his 44 passes were on play action. That's 15.9%. And he was accurate on 2 of 7, which is 28.6%. That's not really that far from Watson. But 7 out of 44. I don't understand how you change that. Like, that's setting up your quarterback to fail.
Yeah.
Watson had a clean pocket on 40 of his 51 downfield passing attempts. That's 78.4%. Savage received a clean pocket on 30 of his 44 deep attempts. That's 68.2%. Watson was under pressure on 21.6% of his downfield passes. And Savage was under pressure on 31.8% of his passes. So there's a huge step up in pressure and a huge step down in terms of quality pass protection. In regards to the windows, Watson had an open window on 39.2% of his passes. He was actually accurate on 60% of those open window passes, where, like, open window being receivers completely wide open, you got an easy throw. He missed 8 throws. He had a 60.0% accuracy percentage, which is pretty bad if you're throwing to an open receiver.
Yeah.
But here's the mind-blowing thing. Savage had an open window on 8 of his 44 pass attempts. That is 18.2% of his pass attempts. But it gets even more mind-blowing. He was accurate on 75% of his open window passes. He was more accurate in that field than Watson was. But wait, it gets even crazier. you thought that was as crazy as you get. Like, no, it can get even crazier. Watson threw it to a tight window downfield on 60.8% of his pass attempts. That's 31 out of 51. He was accurate on 8 of those 31 passes. That's 25.8%. Savage threw into a tight window on 36 of his 44 pass attempts. He had 8 passes where he wasn't asked to throw the ball in a ridiculously impossible window. So 81.8% of his passes were on tight windows. He was accurate on 44.4% of those passes. 44.4% to Deshaun Watson's 25.8%. Stick with me. It still gets crazy.
Deshaun Watson getting swept by Tom Savage.
And Bill O'Brien, too.
Bill O'Brien's losing his damn mind right now. Savage had 9 accurate passes that were dropped by receivers in comparison to Watson's 3. The crazy part is, like, when charting this, Hopkins actually had 5 of them for Savage. 5 of those 9 inaccurate incompletions, as I call them, which is really bizarre because this is DeAndre Hopkins. This is a guy that probably has the best hands in the league. Why is he screwing Savage like that? Like, I don't get it. And on the flip side, inaccurate completions. Watson had 6. That's where, like, the receiver has to make an unnecessary adjustment and still make the catch. Watson had 6 of those passes. Savage had 3. So to sum this all up, because this is extremely long, this means Savage received a far worse offense than what Watson had, despite having the same players. The coaching completely changed, and that completely messed him up. In other words, Watson's injury, to me, didn't matter nearly as much as Bill O'Brien completely changing the offense, getting rid of play action, getting rid of read option. Don't get me wrong. Savage is absolutely atrocious. He is awful.
Oh, I've watched him play awful. Multiple times in person.
Should never be. Yeah,
he's the second worst quarterback on that team.
Oh, man. shouldn't even be a star. Shouldn't be anywhere near a starter. But in his defense, O'Brien asked him to be Aaron Rodgers, Cam Newton, when he wasn't even close to that, and that's just terrible coaching.
Last question from me. In the receiving game this year, you know, you talked about Robiskie and whatever as far as that's concerned, but I think the strangest thing to the Titans season about to me was that they clearly made an effort in the draft to get much more explosive at the receiver position. I mean, you draft Corey Davis 5th overall, you trade up in the 3rd round with the Patriots to select Taywan Taylor, and then you don't throw to either of those players throughout the season. And this is not a coaching staff that has an issue with rookies, because last year, Tajay Sharp, a 5th round pick, got something like 60, 70 targets during the season. So
I'm still forgetting that Tajae Sharpe exists.
Yeah. From what you've seen from this team on film this year, was it a talent issue? Were they just not getting it? Why did we not see more of not just targets, but Corey Davis and Tywan Taylor actually on the field?
I think it was a mix of talent and coaching, but with talent more like more injury stuff.
It's not Corey like Davis, Eric Decker was doing anything to outplay them.
No, he was awful. Corey Davis was not healthy in his rookie season at all. Played two games before suffering a hamstring injury, missed the next five games before returning week 9 against the Ravens. So this completely limited his impact as a pass catcher and a route runner. He was never really comfortable, and that's something that he should be able to have next season. As for Tywan Taylor, I think he's a versatile route runner and player and could have somewhat of a gadget role, taking jet sweeps under LaFleur's offense in the same way he used Tavon Austin last year. But he also dropped too many passes for his own good. That frequently showed up when I was charting. Ultimately, the bigger issue is it fell on the coaching for also putting these receivers in bad spots. The route combinations were far too predictable, and it just suffocated the entire offense. That is something that should change before his offense, and I honestly expect the diverse play calling to be there, and hopefully that should be the case.
So, okay, I've Blake Bortles is a bad quarterback. I need to say this in a very systematic
yes, out of question.
Really bad. And yet, if I say that and I criticize that he was given a 3-year contract worth almost $20 million a year, and I say that on my timeline, everybody comes out and tries to snark at me and say, no, you don't understand. It's actually a good thing to have Blake Bortles under contract for this money because
these are the same people wanting the Titans to give up a draft pick for Eli Apple.
Right.
Block those people who are not worthy of breathing.
It's tough. And
explain. You need to eliminate their ability to breathe.
Help me.
This is polluting the NFL.
As somebody who doesn't have any ties to the Titans or anything like that, help me convince these people that it's not a good idea to have Blake Bortles on your team, if at all possible.
And let me chime in real quick before you start. Blake Bortles was the 3rd overall pick of the 2014 NFL draft. And during that AFC Championship game, Tony Romo talked about him as if he was an undrafted free agent making his first start due to an injury. Wow, that's
ironic. Romo was an undrafted free agent.
Yeah, he was. Nice job of throwing to that wide open tight end 2 yards away from the line of scrimmage. Man,
that's absolutely incredible.
It was... Yeah, so go right ahead. Enlighten us.
So, short answer, Bortles sucks at the end. Long answer, Bortles' new contract reflects the attitude the Jaguars front office has on how they evaluate quarterbacks. They don't really evaluate based on how poised Bortles is or how accurate he is, because he's never been one of those quarterbacks. He sucked in those categories. We know this. The Jaguars evaluated him based on how little he screwed up in the postseason and how far the Jaguars advanced last year. That's all it came down to. Wins. That's how they evaluated him. The reality is, Bortles was asked to do very little in 2017. The previous year in 2016, he ran a vertical offense and put together probably the worst quarterback season I've ever seen. He could not operate a vertical offense at all. The worst season I've ever seen from
Which is so strange because he has such a big arm.
Yeah, but having a big arm doesn't mean you have great arm talent.
Yeah.
You can't always, like, if you have great arm talent, you can adjust the velocity you're throwing, you can adjust the trajectory. And this is Blake Bortles we're talking about, and he can't do that at all.
And it's funny because people want to, you know, praise Blake Bortles and in the same breath want to say Cam Newton's a running quarterback. He's below average.
That's funny because people are comparing Newton and Bortles, saying like, "Oh, Bortles is better passer."
I have watched both of them play in person multiple times. Both of them have come to Nashville multiple times within the last couple of years. There's no comparison there. Cam Newton is the best athlete I've ever watched in person. I have no issue saying that. And I saw 30-year-old Adrian Peterson. I have seen Von Miller, but I mean Cam's just a freak. And I've also seen Blake Bortles in week 17 last year throw two of the worst interceptions to Kevin Byard that I've ever seen a quarterback throw.
He was so bad. Worse in person than you could ever imagine.
completely useless. But yeah, I actually do agree. Like Newton and Bortles, like their offenses are as distant from each other as humanly possible. Newton is asked to run the exact same offense that Bortles ran last year, except he does it way, way, way better. So Bortles was completely trashed in the offense. Last season, offensive coordinator Nathaniel Hackett purposely stripped Bortles' responsibility to the lowest common denominator. This meant safer throws, more quarterback-friendly environments, like you said, two-yard passes that were supposedly impressive to Tony Romo, probably because he's on crack or something, I don't know. This is Tony Romo. Like, he could be on anything. And we'd say, like, oh, this is like him sober. It really doesn't matter. Anyways, his contributions waned from, like, holding the Jaguars back to just barely being a bus driver. And that's being generous. I don't think the Jaguars are setting for mediocrity at quarterback because, well, Blake Bortles isn't even good enough to be mediocre. He had a better season in 2017 and 2016, don't get me wrong. But that's completely because his responsibility was make zero mistakes, hand the ball off to Leonard Fournette, and compliment a loaded defense. Loaded defense. It's silly to even compare him to guys like Andrew Luck and Marcus Mariota as a result because of how easy his offensive scheme is. Mm-hmm. Jaguars should make the playoffs next year, but I wouldn't count them to knock off the Patriots unless they somehow draft a quarterback, somehow move on from this Bortles mess that they've decided to put themselves into.
Okay, I know I said last question, but this really is the last question, and I thought of it as you were talking.
Right.
And I'm gonna give you one last opportunity to dump some more trash on the AFC South teams that aren't the Titans. Will has been preaching to us ever since really like May that he doesn't like Leonard Fournette, and Matthias and I were both initially skeptical of his opinion, but I think we kind of came along. Leonard Fournette, not very good, is he?
Yeah, I mean he's an okay runner, but backtrack. Like a lot of people compared him to Adrian Peterson coming out of college, and I think they're right. Did they?
No, they did. Okay. They did. I'm saying that's a horrific comparison.
Oh, okay. Hear me out. Not nearly as good as Adrian Peterson. Not nearly as good as a runner, but both of them are just known for runners. Neither like they weren't known for being a contribution in the receiving game. Adrian Peterson, whenever he was forced to be a receiver with the Saints or the Cardinals, completely stumped. Same thing in Minnesota, just wasn't part of his game. He was part of a time where you could live more as a running back, didn't really need to be a receiving back. That's basically the same thing with Leonard Fournette. He's more of a power guy. You run up the middle, you run up to the side. They actually use him in a very limited way. They don't give him a lot of directions to run into, just up the middle, maybe move a few yards and occasionally break for 20, 30 yards or something like that. But he wasn't known as receiving back in college, and I'm not sure he can be receiving back in the NFL.
Jonathan, this has been so much fun. I'm sure this won't be the last time that we have you on this show. Thank you so much for taking the time. And before we let you go, tell our listeners how they can connect with you on social media and see your gift threads and everything else.
I am on Twitter with the handle at BrickWallBlitz. I changed my name from Jonathan Kinsley to Johnny Kinsley because that's my actual name. But that's not the important part. The important part is my handle is BrickWallBlitz. I also write for Purple PTSD, which is a Minnesota Vikings site, and I make a lot of kick-ass gift threads. And I'm also charting for the 2017-2018 edition of the Deep Ball Project, which I may do more this week. So I got my hands full. It was very fun to come on this podcast. I really appreciated you guys. Thanks so much.
We look forward to the next time. Keep up the good work. All right, we will be back next week to recap the combine, talk about some players that helped their draft stock, some players that hurt their draft stock. Until then, for Matthias Wadner, Will Lomas, and Johnny Kinsley, I am Luke Worsham. Thank you for listening to the Titan Size Podcast. If you want more, please subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher or Blog Talk Radio. You can listen to us three different ways and leave a 5-star review and leave a comment. And we will talk to everybody in a week.